Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Tuckians? What the fuckinistas? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How is everybody doing? How are you? You all right? Let's do some dates first. I'm going to be at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City tomorrow and Saturday. 4 shows. Come down. I'll be at the Comedy Attic in Bloomington, Illinois. No, that's not where it is, dummy. Bloomington, Indiana. That's better. August 30th, 31st, and September 1st. I'll be at Acme September 6th, 7th, and 8th, but that is sold out. I'll be at the Comedy Works in Denver September 21 and 22, 4 shows, and Stand Up Live in Phoenix, Arizona, October 13th. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all that info. Get the links to the tickities. Get the links to the tickies. That's what I'm trying to say. Today on the show, it's a very interesting show. For me, I talked to Loser Twersky. He's an actor and former Hasid. As a Jew, I have been at different points in my life obsessively curious about the Hasidim. For a lot of reasons. I'll get into it a little more in a second. He was in the documentary One of Us. You've seen him on that High Maintenance on HBO. He's been on that. He's also in a French film called Felix and Mira, but we'll get to him in a minute. So, all right. Well, yes, it is true. It is true, people. It is true, ladies and gentlemen. I have been added to the cast of the new Joker movie being directed by Todd Phillips, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Robert De Niro. Two of the greatest actors that have ever graced the screen. And I know some of you, given my recent discussions about the slow corruption of our culture and arts by the consolidation of desire around the limited options of big budget blockbuster movies in the form of superhero movies, are probably kind of, thinking, well, look at this. Yeah, big talker. Huh? Look at this guy. He's a hypocrite. He's this or that. I'll be honest with you. My agent's trying to get me an audition for this film, preceded my rants. I do not think that my opinions have changed at all. I have, in my life, as I've mentioned before, read plenty of comic books. But the bottom line is this. I never thought that my life would take me to where I am now. I didn't assume anything when I started this podcast other than I hope I can stay alive. I don't know if I can make a living. I don't know what you do with these podcasts, but I got to stay engaged, stay busy, and try to remain on the right side of the grass. Who would have known that some of my dreams would come true if they were dreams, or some of my ambitions, making my own TV show, developing an audience as a comedian, doing the best comedy I've ever done in my life, having a career in show business, period, that the podcast itself would be successful. So given all that, certainly one of my childhood dreams, and I don't like to use the word bucket list, but certainly something that I thought about in college, I thought about, as long as I was a fan of films, was God, if I was ever an actor, wouldn't it be amazing to be in a scene with Robert De Niro? Wouldn't it be amazing to act with Robert De Niro? Look at him there in Raging Bull and Taxi Driver and The Deer Hunter and Godfather 2, all those when I was in high school, and later, you know, Casino and Goodfellas. I mean, look at Robert De Niro is the best. He's the fucking best, man. How cool would it be to be in a movie with Robert De Niro? How long have I been thinking about that? Most of my life. So, given that the time that we live in does not put a lot of resources into films like The Deer Hunter, or even, I would say, Raging Bull, or certainly not Taxi Driver, but you know, probably not even Goodfellas, really, at this juncture in history. So given that this is the timing, that this is where it's at, once given the opportunity that it was going to happen, that like I got this gig and I'm going to do a couple of scenes maybe with Robert De Niro and Joaquin Phoenix, the next in the line, the succession of great actors. fuck yes, I'm going to do that. Of course I'm going to do that. This is the movie that it's going to be in. And hopefully it'll make the cut. And honestly, it's a pretty great script. So there you have it. Bucket list, dream, whatever. Whatever you may think of what I said, I'm not backing off my assertions in any way, the core argument of what I said. But for those of you who got so offended by that and took it so personally and drew a line, I hope you enjoy me in The Joker. And if I don't make the cut, karma's a bitch. Thank you for all you people that were congratulatory. Thank you for all you people who were snotty. And thank you for all you people who thought that it was somehow some giant conspiracy on my part, a ruse, you know, to either leverage a deal or to supply a punchline today. You give me too much credit, people. You give me too much credit, the three of you that did that. So what can I tell you about what you're about to take in? Loser Twersky was a guy that used to show up. I saw him years ago when I did, geez, man, when was that? I first met him when I was doing some sort of event at the New York TV Festival for the pilot of Marin, my show. Wow, so that goes pretty far back. That goes back to 2010 or something. It was the pilot we were bringing taking around to try to sell the show Marin with Ed Asner. It was a weird little pilot presentation, and it was at the festival, and this guy shows up, this Hasidic Jew. Not Orthodox, Hasidic. He's a Hasidic. He's got the payas, the curls on the side of his head. He's wearing the kippah. He's got the tzitzi, the talis on underneath the jacket. Full-blown Hasidic Jew. Young guy. Very manic, very intense, smoking cigarettes. Was a fan of mine. That's when I first met him. And then I saw him at the Bell House. He came to a live WTF, and I noticed that still Hasidic, still with the payas, still with the kippah, but wearing a sort of a slick suit, not the standard issue black. So that was sort of weird. I'm like, what's up with this guy? Still smoking a lot and yammering on, very manic. And then I saw him again at, he came to my book signing at Barnes & Noble. Apparently I said, oh, you got a haircut, because he was not in the garb and he was not with the payas. So this guy extricated himself from the Hasidic community. Now, I didn't know much about that other than, you know, my own sort of weird, you know, when I'm growing up, when I was a kid, you know, Williamsburg, Brooklyn, you know, we learned about it in Hebrew school. You knew it was there. You kind of wanted to go see them. It was like some sort of like human zoo of for religious fanaticism. Which there are many around the country, but this one very specific, you know, it's like kind of 1800s Poland looking, but the Hasidic are always in my mind when I was younger, like they're the real ones. They're the most committed Jews. They're the ones that are holding up the end for the sort of middle class, bougie, conservative Jews. These guys are doing the real. They're doing the real work. And I've written about this in Jerusalem Syndrome. I've performed bits about visiting the wall in Jerusalem, how they're there, you know, sort of keeping, you know, the channels open for all of us. And I don't know if any of that's true. I had some sort of romanticized, idealistic, or, you know, I always knew they were kind of odd. And I was always taken by the fact that they, odd, even with the payas and everything else, if there's a generic sort of, if I have a sense of like, that guy looks Jewish, that guy doesn't look Jewish, outside of the getup, I thought a lot of these cats, they didn't look that Jewish. And then I started to realize, well, maybe the gene pool is getting a little tight in the Hasidic communities, which is true. But I used to see them cruising around in their station wagons in New York, you know, looking for hookers down on 3rd, you know, like on 27th Street. Like, you know, you start to realize, and then you start to meet, you know, deal with some of them in different ways. You know, you start to get this different impression. There was kind of like a Jewish hillbilly element to them. But they were like a highly religious community. It's almost a theocratic community. They are very limited in their exposure to the world, and they're just full on Jew all the time. Very specifically, ritualistically. So this was a fascinating conversation for me, and a very difficult series of events for Loser. You know who? It's been a struggle, and if you've seen the doc. One of us, you know a little bit about it, but you know, I really got, you know, I kept him around a long time, and I was happy to talk to him, and he is living in an RV here in Los Angeles. He's committed to making it in show business, and it's nice that he's actually developing a show with Norman Lear's company now, and a friend of mine and friend of the show, Moshe Kasher, has been paired with him to run the show. I'm not sure what it's about, and I don't know that we talked about it because this was a while ago. So as I mentioned, Loser, I think I'm pronouncing it right. He's an actor. He's a Hasidic Jew, a Jack Hasidic Jew, as they say, like Jack Mormon. He's a recovering Hasidic Jew, which is much different than a recovering Catholic. It's much different than a recovering anything, because generally you are not completely insulated from the modern world. And that's enforced by your community in order to be in the community. So, and as I said, he's developing a show at Norman Lear's company. This is a very interesting conversation with the Loser Tours.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
You know, like, I've been seeing you around for years, and you've emailed me here and there, and then, like, I watched that The One of Us,
yeah,
the documentary, and I'm like, oh, there's that guy, and then now I know about that guy, yeah. And then you know, I've seen you in a couple of shows,
yeah.
I watched your High Maintenance episode,
yeah,
and then you were in Transparent, but you didn't play an Orthodox Hasid.
No.
But in the High Maintenance, you played, basically it was a companion piece to the documentary.
Yes, because in the documentary, you see me shooting the High Maintenance episode.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, that scene where they show me like a shooting something, I'm shooting High Maintenance.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. So let's go back then, because... You know, the documentary was pretty compelling. I personally thought, I don't know who made it, but I personally thought that they weren't hard enough on the elders.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, it really focused on you guys and the difficulty and insanity of trying to extricate yourselves from the Hasidic community.
Yeah.
You know, which was pretty daunting and scary and weird and cult-like. But I thought they really kind of, It feels like there's a whole other documentary in the abuse issue.
Yeah, well, they didn't want to go too hard because they were trying to tell the story of these three people. They weren't going to
right.
And also,
but they're the onus is on them. The onus is on the elders.
Yeah, but nobody wanted to talk to them. They tried. Nobody wanted to talk to them. They only got this one guy.
Yeah, who is that guy?
So that guy is he's not anybody in the community. He's just a guy. You know, he looks good on camera. He's got a big, long white beard.
But he's not in the community?
He's in the community, but he's not like anybody. He's just a dude.
The one thing that I learned about it that I didn't really put together was that, you know, the community moved and maintained its traditional everything, you know, specifically, you know, as a reaction to Nazis, that they were going to, you know, protect their way of life no matter what. And the idea of continuing to procreate at the level they procreate at was really, it's really, the agenda is on some level to guarantee the survival of that particular strain of Judaism.
Right, yeah, it's partially, like, I think the having so many kids and like the strictures that they added after the Holocaust was partially response to that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the funny thing is, like, I don't know much about like the history of like why they do things. Like, people always ask me, "Oh, why do they wear these hats?" I don't know. That's just what they wear.
I used to do a joke about it.
Oh, about the hats?
Yeah. So God could see them in crowds. It was more of a yarmulke joke, but, well, I mean, those are traditional hats from Poland.
Yes, but they get modernized. They, you know, they change. It's like that. The other thing is, like, people think that it's monolithic and like everybody looks the same. Everybody wears the same. It's a little bit. There's slight differences.
Of course, they update them every few years. The two hat makers that make the hats.
They get taller. They get heavier. They get fancier. They get more expensive. They're like, right. You know, those fur hats. They're like $5,000.
And there must be like one or two companies that make them.
No, there's not more than them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and now they make them in China.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where were they making them before?
They make them by hand in Brooklyn.
Oh.
Yeah. Now they make them in China.
Oh, no kidding. So so there's more chasidim?
There's a lot more chasidim. There's like, I think, a quarter million now in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, so when do you realize you're a chasidim? Wait, I mean, how do you grow up? You grew up in Brooklyn?
I grew up in Brooklyn,
before
yes.
Before Brooklyn became, you know, hipster, your parents were there with in Williamsburg, right?
In Borough Park.
Borough Park.
Yeah.
With the original community.
Yes.
Because when I was a kid, you know, I'm 54, you're young, but there was like this idea that, you know, you could go over there and look at the Jews.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, people still come and they're like, look at them. It's like, you know, it's a tourist attraction. It's like, oh my God, you want to be in Brooklyn and also in the 16th century? They're like, great.
Is it that far back, 16?
Well, like 17th maybe, I don't know.
And what was the name of the guy who founded the Hasidic movement?
Oh, his name was the Baal Shem Tov.
Baal Shem Tov did it.
Yeah, and then they started breaking off into smaller sects and, like, you know, implementing their own changes. So the one I grew up in was called Belz, and it's from Galicia, which doesn't exist anymore, and now it's like Ukraine or Poland, somewhere around there. And
so there's several communities of Hasid throughout Eastern Europe.
Yes.
That broke off from the Baal Shem Tov one way or the other.
Yes. I mean, they didn't like break off in a way like they went against them, but they just like, you know, went their own way. They're like, you know.
They spread out.
Yeah, they spread out.
Right.
Yeah. So I grew up in Borough Park. My dad is a Rebbe, Hasidic leader.
He is?
Yes.
He's a rabbi?
Yeah. He's got his own. There's a difference. There's a Rebbe and there's a rabbi.
The rabbi
is the one who does like the laws. You know, you ask him questions about Jewish law, and the Rebbe is like a spiritual leader. The rabbi is the one that you ask questions about Jewish law.
Oh, okay. So, like, if you've got a problem,
like the legal authority.
So you're gonna go to the rabbi if your neighbor fucked your wife, or if someone stole a chicken,
yes,
or if somebody ripped you off,
yes,
or it's a rent issue.
Yes,
you go solve it. He's gonna open up the Talmud, and figure out a point of reference,
exactly,
and say this is how God wants you to handle this. That's a rabbi.
Yes.
Okay.
And a rebbe is a spiritual leader.
Uh huh. So which means what? He's just a preacher.
Well, he's the one who's supposed to have the direct connection to God. He doesn't have to consult the books. He just asks God.
Oh, really? So in some ways, on a mystical level, he's more important than the rabbi.
Exactly. Yes.
The rabbi's like the judge.
Yeah.
The Rebbe is like the guy who keeps the hustle going.
Basically, yes. Yes.
And your dad was one of those.
Yes.
Does he think of himself as a mystic?
I never asked him. I mean, I think probably deep inside he knows he's full of shit.
Yeah.
But I think so. I mean, he's a person. I mean, it's not like, I don't think he thinks he can speak. He might think that he has because he's like, you know, he's a descendant of rabbis because my whole family was rabbis. That's how it works. It's, you know, it's
the
like
Twersky rabbis.
The Twersky rabbis. The Twersky family. They're all like rabbis. It's like a Kennedy of like the Hasidim.
Really?
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. So when the thing that fascinated about the documentary, because I know so little and I am, you know, sort of fascinated but not educated, because I choose not to do that. But like, you look at my books over there, you know, I've got Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism. I've got the Hasidic Tales. I've got Martin Buber. That Inner Space book is some insane mystical Kabbalah book that someone gave me. But like, it's a little dense. I like the Hasidic Tales and I like Martin Buber.
Well, it's good storytelling. It's really good storytelling. Yeah.
They never end great. A lot of them don't end great. They just end with, then who knows?
Well, you know, like, they end with the Goyim dying. They all end with the Rebbe. The Rebbe made created a miracle and the bad Goyim died. You know, it's great for us. You know, it's like when you're a child, you know, it reiterates, you know, that like, oh, we're the best. You know,
yeah,
we're the OG. We're the chosen.
Yeah.
You know, even amongst the chosen, we are like the OG.
And
we're
you talk like real. You're supposed to. You like have the you have the accent that people make fun of, but it's real.
Yes.
And it's not. It's hard to figure out because it's not because of Hebrew, it's because of Yiddish.
Because of Yiddish, yeah. And also because I didn't speak English.
It's New York and Yiddish is what it is.
Yeah, basically. It's a combination of like New York and Yiddish. But also my mother is Israeli, so I have like a little bit of an Israeli accent.
I can hear that a little bit, yeah. Oh, really? Your father married an Israeli?
Yeah. So my father went to yeshiva, went to study in Israel, and that's where he got introduced to my mother. I mean, they had like all Hasidic dates. It was, you know, arranged, and they had met for like an hour or something, and they got married. They lived in Israel for a year, and then my dad moved back to Brooklyn to take over his dad's synagogue.
Now, was your grandfather alive when you were a kid?
No, none of my grandparents were alive. My mom's dad died when he was 44.
Yeah.
Suddenly, and then his wife, my grandmother, died a couple of months later in a car accident.
Wow.
Yeah. So she lost both her parents when she was
a
kid.
And
like
what about your dad's parents? Was your dad's father the Rebbe in Brooklyn, Borough Park?
Yeah, same house that my father lives now. Same synagogue, same house.
So how many synagogues are there in Borough Park?
Oh, God, there's like, on my block alone, there's five.
Really? And they all have different Rebbes?
They all have different Rebbes.
But are they still, do the communities interact, the different congregations?
So it depends. There's a lot of infighting. So like there's the famous, there are the famous on the Chabad, right? The Lubavitch, the ones that stand on the street and it's like, hey, excuse me, are you Jewish?
Are you Jewish? Come do a tefillin.
Exactly.
Like, right,
so
here,
Chabad,
like, right here in the bathroom, we got to do tefillin.
On the street, they always, when they stop me, are you Jewish? Like, no.
How do they not know? They pay us, they don't give it away?
Even when I had payas and beard, you know, I would go by and it's like, you're not going to ask me?
Yeah. They don't want to ask you. They're afraid.
Jewish. Yeah.
But they're afraid because you
also they assume that I already put on tefillin. They assume
that
I already did it.
That's right. That guy already did it.
He's good. You know,
but there was the rift with Chabad. Why? Because they didn't like the missionary element.
No, so Chabad and Satmar. Satmar is like the biggest, like really extreme Hasidic sect. Like they're the most
Which
famous
ones?
Satmar.
Yeah,
or they're the anti-Zionists. They're the ones who are like.
We live in Palestine. The wall is in Palestine. Israel's not a
they
state.
Don't, like when you sign like the books that they print, it doesn't say printed in Israel. It says printed in Israel, which is the Hebrew word for Eretz Yisrael. So it's like it's Eretz Yisrael. It's not Israel. Israel, the state of Israel, is something else.
How are there a lot of those guys?
Oh yeah, they're huge.
Yeah.
They're the ones, they're based in Williamsburg. They're the ones that people, when they think of Hasidic Jews, like outside of Chabad, they're thinking about Satmar because they're the biggest, the most visible, the most politically connected, the most active.
The thing, what I was going to say is the thing that fascinated me about the documentary was that kid, you know, the one who just like basically didn't know how to read or function.
Yeah, neither did I.
Because it's so insulated?
Yeah, because they don't teach you any they teach you like very, very basic English. There's an hour of English every day, like 4 days a week.
All right, so when do you start? You pay us when you're a little kid, right? Because I see
three
the pay
old.
Us kids.
Yeah.
And that's part of the rule book?
Yes, when you're 3 years old, you get pay us.
Okay, and then what's next?
And then there's bar mitzvah.
No, 10 years, you just walk around with payas and the talis vest without being ordained?
You wear like regular colorful clothes.
Yeah.
But you wear tzitzis, you know, the fringe
That's
thing.
That's what I mean,
underneath it, usually.
Yeah.
And then when you're bar mitzvah, you start wearing the tzitzis outside, and that's when you switch to black and white.
Now, bar mitzvah in the Hasidic community must be like it's a big deal in middle class conservative Judaism for different reasons.
Yeah.
You don't really acknowledge, you know, okay, I'm a man now, whatever that means.
Right.
I get presents. We have a party. Maybe there's a theme.
Yeah.
You know, you get to buy a suit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But for you, it must have been...
No, it means that basically from now on, it means you have to fast on all the fast days. You have to keep all the rules.
Yeah.
It's like you have to fast on Yom Kippur, you have to fast on Tisha B'Av, like, you know, you got to do all the rules. You're basically an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And you start putting on tefillin. Every day, yeah.
Every day is tefillin.
Every day tefillin.
I don't even have tefillin.
Well,
I just found my talus. I mean, I had it. It was here. I'm cleaning things out, but I have a nice talus.
Well,
but I don't have tefillin.
I don't have mine either. I don't know where. I do have them. I think I know where they are. I still have most of my stuff.
Yeah,
I use them for, like, you know, films and stuff. You know,
but are you a little typecast?
Yeah, but you know what? At least I'm working.
Yeah.
I would love to do other things, but you know, this is the most of the work I get is that.
All right, so you bar mitzvah at 13, yeah. And then what's expected of you, given that you come from a family of rebbes?
Yeah.
Are you expected to be the rebbe?
Because I have like four other brothers.
Older?
I have two older ones and two younger ones.
Well, how do they designate which one?
Usually the oldest one,
yeah.
But there's always a fight. That's why, like, right now there's two Satmars, there's two Babavs, there's like every sect that came with one Rebbe from the Holocaust,
yeah,
you know, and they had a bunch of kids, and now the kids are splitting off. There's like two visions, there's like two of everything now.
Is that why there's so many synagogues?
Partially, yeah. But also, like, for example, like, you'd say, like, when you say, like, I'm part of Babav, they say, which Babav, 45 or 48? 45th
really?
Street or 48th Street, yes.
Oh, so everyone knows.
Yeah, everyone knows. Like Satmar, you Satmar Williamsburg or Satmar Curious Joel?
And in terms of being part of whichever congregation, is that just the community has to decide? It breaks up the community? Who are they going to go with? Or is it they prefer the guys? Like because people in conservative Judaism, a lot of times they change temples just because they don't like the rabbi. Is that the way it works there?
Well, so I mean, it is a personal choice. I mean, people decide which rabbi they like, and that's the one they go with.
But then is there friction between the two?
Oh, yeah. When Satmar was splitting up, there was violence. Oh, there was fires, there was stonings, there were burning up cars, there was a lot of violence. Well, same with Babav, too.
To what end? To keep it one community?
No, but basically to kick out, like if like Satmar and Williamsburg, like they would want to institute some new policy, and like the guys who are splitting off wouldn't like it, you know, a fight would break out.
Wow.
You know, or like if one of his people
they're
would show up.
Burning cars?
Oh, yeah.
So then how does the rabbi handle that? That's a lot of sit-downs with the rabbi. I would imagine. Is there still just one rabbi for all these communities?
No. So the rabbis, like the ones like who are the judges, they also split. So some of the rabbis go with one rebbe, and some of them go with the other rebbe.
It's real politics.
It's real politics. Yeah, there's like it's like if you go to like a Hasidic synagogue, which also the other thing you have to understand, people think that they don't socialize.
Yeah,
they do socialize. They don't have bars. They don't go to bars. They socialize in the synagogue because you pray three times a day.
It seems like there's a lot of singing in the socializing and a lot of arguments.
Yeah, a lot of arguments. So like, I don't know if you know about the mikveh?
Yeah, the bath.
The bath, but the men go to the bath every day.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yes, every day before morning prayers, you go to the bath, and you go in there, and it's like probably thousands of people go through it every day.
It's like a schwitz or just a bath?
It's so there's showers. Some of them have a schwitz, but there's the big pool that you go in and you immerse yourself in. So a lot of people, they just go there and they just sit like it's a hot tub, and they're just like arguing about Satmar this, Satmar that. They're arguing politics.
Just dozens of men.
Just dozens of completely naked.
Men, completely naked, naked bearded men arguing.
Yeah, and there's always this one guy who dries his groin.
Yeah.
Like he puts one foot up on the bench.
Yeah, right.
Like there's always this one guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
then
there's the one like really, really religious guy who doesn't want to look anywhere. He just, he keeps his towel on up. Right up to the bath, and then he just jumps in and jumps out and splashes everyone because he doesn't want to see anything, and he's just immersing.
Yeah,
you know?
He's doing that thing.
Yeah,
that, what
the
is
thing.
The immersing? Is that what's the ritual mean?
It's just cleansing yourself, basically.
But is there showers involved in casino?
Well, there's showers. So here's the...
Because I don't want to be weird and generalized, but I've been around some smelly chassids.
No, a lot of them, like, they believe... Because life is about... spirituality. Life is not about the body.
Or
the
cleaning
body
your suit?
Well, the body is just a vessel, so it's not important.
Right, but that means that there's a lot of enjoyment, so you don't have to worry about what you eat, as long as it's kosher.
Basically.
I imagine doctors in the Hasidic community have to be bringing their hands all the time.
Oh, yeah. They don't have their own doctors because they didn't go to college, but yeah.
Oh, see, so that must be the one thing they don't have.
They don't have doctors. They have very, very few lawyers.
Really?
Yeah. So like whole,
there's no yeshiva or Jewish university for chassids.
That's the thing. Like people think of Jews and they're like, oh, they're the educated ones. Hasidic Jews get zero education. There's no college. There's no high school. I have no high school diploma. I couldn't read or write when I was 18.
Really?
Yeah. How I barely that, spoke English.
How is that legal?
It's not. But they get away with it.
Why?
Political power. There's actually an organization in Brooklyn called Yafed. They're fighting against, they're suing the state of New York to enforce the laws. They had to sue the state to enforce its own laws in the schools.
Because they just don't want to do it because it's insulated, because they pay their rent, because they have their property owners? Well, I mean, I don't know how they get away with that.
Because they have a voting block. They're voting block. They vote as a block.
Oh, okay.
So if the Rebbe says, like, everybody
all
votes
of them,
for
no
Blasio,
matter what the infighting is, that's something that transcends the infighting. We can fight amongst themselves, yeah. But when it comes to what's good for the Hasidim,
basically,
then we vote for that guy.
The guy has to be socially conservative and fiscally liberal.
Uh-huh.
So give us all the government programs you can, but don't let the gays get married.
Right.
Basically.
So you're telling me the Hasids, it's like the opposite of what everybody thinks about the Jews. They're living off the welfare system.
Yeah.
And they're just...
Well, not all of them, obviously.
No, I know, but they're not... Like, they're not all diamond merchants and selling cameras.
Not anymore. You know, I used to work at B&H, actually.
Did you?
Yeah. I have a good picture of, like, me in the B&H Fest with the Payus and everything.
B&H for the audio equipment.
Yeah. It's huge. It's a massive company.
Is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there. It does billions of dollars a year in business.
Yeah, they sell all the mixers and things, yeah. I still get the catalog.
Yeah. I used to work there, and I used to have like, filmmakers come in. I had no idea who they were. I remember, like, I had this, like, one modern, like, more modern Orthodox Jew next to me. And he was like, you know who that was? That was Harrison Ford. I'm like, who's that?
Yeah. My God. Come on. What movies are you watching?
Well, I wasn't watching anything at the time.
They didn't let you watch movies?
No, there's no movies. There's no TV. There's no newspapers. There's no radio.
All right. So you get bar mitzvah. Now, now which one of your brothers is going to be Rebbe?
Oh, we don't know. They're going to fight it out.
How do you fight it out?
I don't know. I know whose side I'm on.
yo, really? You picked a brother?
I have a favorite brother.
Yeah.
You know?
So it has to be, it's within the family?
It's within the family, yes.
That your dad's going to make the call?
It's probably going to be in his will, yeah.
Oh, that's how it works. Yeah. So they don't even know what that, so they're both kissing your father's ass one way or the
basically,
other?
Basically, yeah. They're all grabbing real estate.
Yeah, you mean mental real estate?
No, like actual real estate.
What, really?
Yeah. So, like, my father, like, you know, he makes a living from the synagogue, obviously, from donations.
Yeah.
But he also has, you know, a few buildings that helps. I mean, he's got 12 kids. You know,
there's 12 of you?
Yeah.
How many girls and boys?
Seven sisters.
You have seven sisters.
Seven sisters, four brothers.
They're all, and you're the only one that's, you're the only renegade?
Yep.
Do you talk to any of them?
Some of them, yeah. There's some of them who, like, just completely ignore. My sister got married a couple of weeks ago, and I went to the wedding, and some of them just, like, pretended I wasn't there. They just completely ignored me.
Really?
Yeah. And it's actually interesting because, like, I don't know if I told you this, but when you did that episode with your father, I think the 500th episode.
Yeah.
I was driving, and I it touched me so much, I had to pull over and cry. And I hadn't spoken to my parents at that point, like, for probably 7-8 years. And I decided at that moment that I'm going to try and make it right.
Yeah.
I'm
going
to try to reach out to my dad and see. And we actually did reconcile. And then one of us came out and he stopped talking to me again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So just recently.
Well, he didn't see it, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't seen a movie.
Did you throw him under the bus?
No.
No.
No, I never. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
You know, I just wish that, you know, I understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in it. And I just wish he understood where I'm coming from, and which he might never.
But it's intentional. I mean, they're surrounded by modernity, and I have to assume that they have cell phones.
Yeah,
you know. So they filter
cell phones.
Really, like China?
The best way to understand what's going on in Borough Park and Williamsburg is think of it as North Korea.
Right.
Everything is censored. There's no outside influence. That's why they don't teach you English, because if you can read and write English, then you might read a book, and then you might find out that, you know, there's a world out there. So, like, when I was a kid and I would, you know, I'd never seen a movie. I'd walk on the street.
But it's fucking nuts. You're in New York. You're walking around.
Yes. I would walk down the street and I would see, like, let's say maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, if I would walk down the street, I see a billboard for, like, say, Mission Impossible. It would say Mission Impossible March 4th. I would have no idea what that means. I would have no idea what that's about. To me, it's a goy with a gun. And from what I would see, I would look at that and I was like, okay, I get it. Goyim have guns. Goyim are murders.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a movie. I don't know what. I don't know anything.
What is the day to day? I mean, like, what, like who, what are the, because like it was always my assumption that in the community, I see, it's surprising to me that they don't have doctors, they don't have lawyers. Well, you don't, theoretically they don't need lawyers for most of what the community needs to deal with. Yeah. They go to the rabbi, right?
Yeah.
And in terms of like, you know, so, and everybody is employed. You have bakers, you have, you know,
electricians,
tailors, electricians, yeah. All that yeah. stuff. But where yeah. do they get trained? Do they get trained in Hasidic training?
Well, no, now you have Hasidic computer programmers. They're just, you know, they're good improvisers. They're good survivors. They've learned how to survive. So my brother is a computer programmer. I mean, he actually works at B&H, you know, and he is really, really good. He's self-taught.
He still works at B&H?
Yeah, he's self-taught. You know,
but you have all, you have 12 of you, and you're all living in the same house.
No. They're all, most of them are married now.
Right, but I mean, back in the day,
yeah.
Was there ever a time where you were all 12 there, or no? There
no,
was such
no.
A...
I went off to yeshiva in England when I was like 14.
Okay, so you're 14, so you're the son of a big rebbe, and you know you get to choose the yeshiva thing. There must be some class distinction.
Yeah. So if you're like, if your father is like
kind
a big rebbe,
yeah.
If your father's like a big rebbe, he has his own yeshiva, and then you go to your father's yeshiva. But my father's not that big.
Oh, really?
So I had to go to another yeshiva.
He's a minor rebbe?
He's a minor rebbe, yeah. Yeah, he's like a B-list rebbe.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And do you, why England?
So, because I got kicked out of every school I went to.
How do you get kicked out of school if they're just teaching Yiddish and Jewish stuff?
Well, you can still make trouble. You can still not learn even like Torah. If you don't like classrooms, which I don't, you know, it doesn't matter what it is.
So you're making trouble.
I'm making trouble, yeah.
Like what?
Well, it was one time where I was, so you have the classrooms.
Yeah.
And then after they teach you the class, so after you get bar mitzvah, this is the thing. So after you get bar mitzvah, you go to yeshiva. Before
yeah.
that, you go to a cheder, which is like a elementary school. Yeah. You go to yeshiva and you're there every day from 6 a.m. to like 10 p.m.
Yeah.
All day. You study all day. And the way it works.
Torah,
yes.
When do you learn Yiddish? Yiddish is
just the spoken language.
That's what you speak in the house.
Yes. Yeah. You don't study it. You just speak it.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
So everybody's still speaking Yiddish.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
Aren't there a couple of different strands of Yiddish?
There is. Yeah. So there's like the
Russian, German, Russian
Yiddish, Yiddish, more German Yiddish, Yiddish
Polish
yeah.
Yiddish.
Like the Israeli Yiddish sounds a little different. You know, it has like the R is like R.
Yeah.
And the Brooklyn Yiddish, the R is more like a rolling R, like
yeah.
a R.
Yeah. But it's all understandable to you.
It's all understandable, yeah. Yeah.
All right, so you go to it's 6 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Yes, all day long. You study all day long. And so you go to class, and after class, everybody goes into the big sanctuary where they study together.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when class was done, for example, I took a couple of chairs, I laid down, and I wanted to take a nap.
Yeah.
And people kept coming in and turning the lights on.
Yeah.
So I took
other kids?
Yeah, other kids.
Yeah.
You know, so I took off the cover from the light switch, and I stuck my key in there and popped the fuse and...
That
and
was that.
Shut down electricity for the whole building.
Yeah. So you could take a nap.
So I could take a nap.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're already a problem.
I'm a problem.
Independent yeah. thinker.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But it strikes me now, even now, with you know, sitting with you and your disposition and the fact that, you know, you're still sort of, you got pay us for roles or whatever you got, yeah. but you still got it. I don't get the feeling that you don't believe in God.
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
How can I? I mean, like, there's like, it doesn't make sense to me.
All right, but when you're a kid, how, like, is it just taken for granted? Because, like, you know, the Jewish God is given the books, is a fairly complex entity.
Not to us, not to Hasidim.
Well, no, but I mean, but you got to know the books. You're studying all day long. I mean, you know, with Christians, one give or take, it's just sort of like, you take Jesus into your heart and you're done.
Right.
You're done. You can live your life and go to church on Sunday and try to be a good person. And that's that. I mean, yeah. It just seems like, unless you get deep into Catholicism,
yeah.
that the religions like Islam and Judaism at the level that you were practicing it is fairly complicated, very demanding and all consuming.
Yeah, but that's the difference between Hasidic Jews and all the other Jews.
Right.
Hasidic Jews do not study any like theology or philosophy. We don't ask those kind of questions. We don't go into that. We just study the laws. We just study like the laws and the spirituality of it, like the feelings of it. And like, so all the other stuff, all the theological stuff, the philosophical stuff is taken for granted. That's like set in stone. There is a God. And he gave us the Torah, and then he gave us the Baal Shem Tov, and that's the way it is. And like that part does never get. We don't even study like the like the the whole Bible. We only study the first five books. Hasidim right. don't even study the rest of the Bible. That's the crazy thing about Hasidim. They took like these spiritual ideas
yeah.
and turned them into dogma. That's what they did. That's I think one of their biggest problems
mm-hmm.
is like that a lot of what they do and what they say has no basis in Jewish law.
In terms of like you know new people coming in outside of just people who are born into it, is that something you see
no.
often?
No, very rare.
Right,
it's very rare.
Yeah, unless they marry into it.
They wouldn't marry into it either.
I don't know. Some people are fanatics and they have all kinds.
Yeah, you know, like, I
know you're not an expert, but it's not something you saw. It was just a, you know,
it's very rare.
What about inbreeding?
Inbreeding? Well, I'm going to try to make this as uncomplicated as I can, but it's going to be hard. So my mother, my mother's parents are first cousins.
Right.
Okay, and then my mother has, now she has, I think, 12 siblings left. A lot of them died. But my mother's youngest brother married his oldest brother's daughter. So, like, in my mother's family, there's a ton of inbreeding.
Yeah.
Like, cousins and first cousins and nieces and nephews and uncles, they're all in marriage. And there's an old joke they say, they're like, well, yeah. if he's a good boy, why give him away to another family? And if he's not a good boy, why should another family find out about it? So either way, just keep him in the family,
uh-huh.
you know?
So that's the way it goes.
Yeah, but it's not every family. So, but and they do like genetic tests. So like when you're like sick, when you turn 16 or 17, there's like a nurse that comes to yeshiva and takes everyone's blood and he gets a barcode. Everybody gets a barcode.
Yeah.
And it goes into a database. And then when they start doing arranged marriages, the shatran, the matchmaker,
yeah.
would call up. And say, I have number 54333 and number blah, 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 blah. Are they a genetic match? Can they marry? Are they going to have Down syndrome kids or whatever?
So that's how they do it.
That's how they
do
it.
So it's not, you don't look at the family tree anymore.
No.
You just look at the crapshoot of genetics.
Basically, yeah.
So they're only concerned with certain genetic matching. Like
yeah.
they know that this plus this equals this.
Right. They don't want like, you know, sick kids.
So they're basically saying, you can be family as long as we don't get them.
Exactly. As long as it doesn't, you know, as long as you have healthy kids, why not?
But it's weird because this is sound crazy, but like I used to think that, like I'd see a lot of Hasidim, I'd say, you know, if you shave this stuff off, he doesn't look Jewish.
Yeah. They're like redheads and
yeah,
like
right.
blondes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was a blonde boy. When I was a boy, I was blonde. My mom is blonde.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I have blue eyes. I mean, I don't look Jewish. When I like clean up and I shave and yeah. everything, people think I'm Irish.
So, all right, so, you know, once you start having these rebellions, you're still going along with it. You still believe in God as a kid.
Yeah, well, I'm figuring it out. I'm questioning it. I'm making a lot of trouble, you know, and I...
But what'd you do in England? That must have been different. So you grow up in fucking Brooklyn, then you go to England. It feels the same to you? Like the communities that as insulated?
Well, so I got sent to a boarding school.
A boarding yeshiva.
Yeah, a boarding yeshiva
right, so
in England. It's
right.
not so it's an hour north of London in a little town called Hitchin. Actually, it's not in Hitchin. It's like outside of a little town called Hitchin. It's in the middle of nowhere. You're surrounded by fields.
Yeah.
And you never leave the premises.
And it's just all payas.
All payas, all boys. Yep, all boys.
And the same thing, 6 to 10 at night?
Yep, all day for like 6 months.
But what
semester.
Are you, just reading Torah?
Reading Torah, you're praying on Sabbath, you know, you're dancing, you know, you're singing, you're eating. Smoking, a lot of smoking.
Yeah, they yeah. don't mind smoking.
Well, that particular yeshiva didn't mind smoking.
No, but I mean, yeah. even like in New York, I used to see these fucking Chassids in their station wagons cruising for hookers.
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
But is that another thing that the community is like okay with? Because I heard about like a lot of these Orthodox women, these Hasidic women, they got venereal diseases.
Yeah, they get them from the hookers, from yeah. their husbands, yeah. Well, they look the other way. The community looks the other way.
Why?
Especially if you're like a rich guy and like someone important, and like, yeah, you know, he gives a lot of money to the shul, he gives a lot of money to the schools, you know, like, yeah, you know, so he does that. That's between him and God.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah, certain things are between him and God. But apparently, you know, apparently some other thing is like, oh, no, we got to take care of it ourselves.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So they yeah. just decide within the community.
Yeah, people look the other way.
So you spend you're in England for how many years?
Yeah, so I basically get bar mitzvah, I spend a year in yeshiva in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I get kicked out, I spend another year in a yeshiva in upstate New York, I get kicked out again, and then nobody wanted to take me anymore. They're like, this is a problem kid, we don't want to deal with him.
So do you have to go sit with the rabbi to discuss this?
No, it was because my father is a rebbe, so like he gets to do whatever he wants.
And what was he doing? Was he just being a father?
Oh, he was going insane. He was losing his mind. He didn't know what to do with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he never knew what to do. He was always kind of lost. I was that one kid that just like, he had no idea what I wanted and what my deal was.
But were there other kids like you that you connected with? I mean, at least, like, did you find any other peers who were troubled kids in this way?
No,
in the community?
No, because the troubled kids were like into stuff that I wasn't into. To me, I mean, I'm 32, so I'm still trying to figure out my childhood and what it all meant. I just didn't fit in. I just didn't like any of it.
What are the other troubled Hasidic kids doing?
Oh, they go out at night, like not like clubbing, but they get into trouble. They drive. They sometimes smoke weed.
Yeah.
Yeah. They get into regular kid trouble.
Yeah.
And my kind of trouble was just like bizarre. It was just like bizarre behavior. It's like, who shuts down the electricity till he wants to take a nap?
Yeah. And how'd you get kicked out of the one in upstate?
It was Purim, like the Jewish Halloween.
Yeah.
And we're in the middle of prayers, and I think I started doing like stupid tricks in the middle of prayers, like what do you call these cans that spray like string?
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, silly like string. In the middle of prayers,
silly string.
Yeah. Silly string. I did that. It was just like, right. I did things for attention.
Are you the youngest?
No, I'm number four.
Oh,
so as long as they gave me like out of 12, yeah. As long as they gave me a stage and they let me sing and they let me, you know, lead the prayers, yeah. I was happy. If I wasn't getting attention, you know, all hell broke loose.
So that's right. So you were a class clown. You needed attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. For some reason, your brain, like, you know, I guess that the idea is that you set the dogma in place in such a strong way that the kid does not have the traditional yearnings for sort of parental attention, nurturing, right. That kind of stuff. So like the religion and the community was supposed to fill that void. And yeah, it didn't fill it for you.
And also like it didn't let my brain expand, you know, beyond the borders.
You had desire.
I had desire. There's so much to do. I had curiosity.
Yeah, once you realize that every billboard for a movie is not just about boys with guns.
Exactly.
You were like, there's something else going on across the street.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so there's like old. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, there was one goy on our block lived right next door to us.
Yeah,
and at the top of the stairs, the second floor of our house, I could look into their house, into their bedroom.
They're watching TV,
and they were seeing, and I couldn't see because I got glasses late in life. So for like,
you couldn't read, you couldn't speak, you couldn't see.
I couldn't see because my parents thought I was lying when I said I couldn't see. They didn't take me to the eye doctor. So I could just see the flickering TV. I couldn't see what was on it. I would just stand by that window for hours and just like wonder what is happening in that house.
Yeah.
You know, so to me, it was always just, I have an intense curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, I would take things apart, like toys, just like to see how it works.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't put them back together. I wouldn't figure out how it works, but I took it apart.
Right.
You know?
Sure. Right. So, so you had this this drive that it was not, you know, you were not spiritually satisfied and you were not materialistically satisfied. Right. You weren't emotionally satisfied.
Yeah.
So after England, do you graduate from yeshiva?
You don't graduate, you get married. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's your graduation. Your wedding is your graduation. So they send me off to this boarding school where, like, you're there for, like, 6 months out of the year, and then you go home for, like, for Passover or, like, you know, the holidays.
Yeah.
And so over there, I kind of, like, found my place because I was away from my parents, you know, and I was able to relax, and I actually became a pretty good boy. I studied, you know, and I that's when I developed my performance, you know, skills.
What'd you do?
I would sing. I would, you know, just lead the prayers, lead the Sabbath meals, you know, and yeah, I became a little bit of a macha, and then I got married.
So you got arranged marriage?
I had an arranged marriage. Yeah,
they did the gene testing.
They did gene testing. Yeah, compared barcodes. You know,
the barcodes were passed.
Yeah, yeah, we matched up.
And you didn't know her?
No, I didn't know her at all.
Was she from Brooklyn?
No, she was from Muncie. She was from upstate New York, like Rockin' County.
And how did that deal go down? What's the deal between the dads and the Hasidic community? What's the dowry situation?
So the way it works is there's a matchmaker. They go to like the, I think they go to the girl's parents first, and they say, well, there's this boy, Luza Twersky, you know, and
a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, well, they didn't say that, you know. And like it's, you know, his dad is the Foltachana Rebbe, you know, Twersky. So they start doing some research, and they say, okay, we're interested. And then he goes to my parents, says, well, we have, you know, I don't want to say her name, but them, and are you interested? And so, and when both say yes,
both families,
yeah, both families say
both
yes,
fathers or mothers,
fathers and mothers, yeah, both. And they start doing research. They start calling the school. They start calling her job. And, you know.
Were they doing the same thing with you?
Yeah.
And they still signed off on it?
And they still signed off on it. Apparently, they weren't sure. And then what you have then is you have a meeting. So my mom goes to meet the woman. And her dad comes to meet me. And we sit down for a couple of hours. And
what did he do?
He ran an embroidery business.
For Talis?
Yeah. For like Talis and like, you know, all the ornaments for the shul, for the synagogue. He does that.
Uh-huh.
So I meet her and it's didn't go that well. It was like an
Where'd
hour.
Where'd you meet her?
At her sister's house.
And she's got the wig on and everything?
No, she doesn't have a wig on.
No wig.
You only put it on after you get married.
Oh, right,
you
okay.
So she has a ponytail, you know, she's pretty and she's very shy and very quiet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am not that.
Yeah, but that can work.
Sometimes, but it didn't work. There was just no conversation happening. And I go back to my dad and I'm like, yeah, I don't know. And that's also like unusual. Usually don't say no.
Really?
Yeah. Usually just say yes. Because like, yeah, you have to give a reason why you say no. And so, like, what could be your reason? You haven't slept with her. You barely spoke to her. And like, how do you know what you want? You don't know what you want. So how are you going to say no?
But in their minds, all they want are kids. They don't give a fuck, right?
No.
Whether you get along or not is not the issue.
No.
Because women are primarily, silenced initially. But I have to assume that at some point, you know, like any other relationship, you know, once, you know, everyone is surrendered to the situation, if no one's fighting, I have to assume that some marriages within the Hasidic community are fairly dramatic.
Yeah, but they always say like, oh, look at us, our marriages work because there's less divorce. Well, there's less divorce because people have no choice.
Yeah.
By the time you realize that you've fallen in with someone, you know, you got five kids. What are you going to do now? Walk away?
But is that just...
People are stuck.
But you just...
They're not happy. They're stuck.
No, of course. I get that. But there must be bitterness and fighting and domestic abuse.
Probably. I mean, my parents, I mean, they didn't talk much. Oh. I mean, they're both living their own lives. I mean, my mother's raising 12 children. My dad is, you know, running a synagogue.
So you marry this girl. Even your father says, fuck you.
I do end up marrying her. At first I said no. And then a couple of weeks passed and my rabbi, so like the dean of my yeshiva, who I was very, very close to. It's literally the only guy who I have any nice things to say about from that community. He was a really, really nice guy. I really loved
him. Not a rebbe, a rabbi.
Yeah, he's a rabbi. He was the head of the yeshiva.
Okay. Yeah. A wise man.
A very wise man. Like a super, like probably one of the nicest people I ever meet.
Why did you like him? Why did he resonate with you?
Because he actually cared.
And did he understand your dilemma?
Yes. Yeah, he did. He's like, when I said, you know, I don't think I believe in God. He's like, oh, don't worry. You know, it's a teenage thing. You'll get over it. You know, but he said it with such heart. You know, I felt like he really meant it. And this is the kind of guy who would like leave his house in the morning from London with like a bag of lunch from his wife. And then he would see a homeless guy in the street. He would pull over and go out there and sit on the curb with him and show him, oh, see, this is the chicken. And here's the potatoes.
Yeah.
And would just give him the silverware and everything. And just, he was, I mean, he would go to his arch enemy like to borrow money for like some other sick person.
Uh-huh.
He was a completely selfless person.
Uh-huh.
Like, was a wonderful guy. So he found out that I had what they call, it's called a bishoud. Like when you first meet your the woman, it's called a bishoud. That meeting's called a bishoud. So he found out I had a bishoud and I said no. He calls me up. He was very sick at the time. He had cancer. And he says listen, loser, they don't know your history yet. You know?
Yeah.
You got to say yes because the older you're going to get, I was 18. He's like, the older you're going to get, people are going to start wondering why you're not married yet. And then they're going to start digging in. They're going to find out all your history before you came to my yeshiva. And then you're never going to be able to get married. This woman wants to marry you. Just marry her. It's going to be great. I said, yeah, but I don't like the way she looks. And I'm like, he's like, oh, what the fuck? Forget about pretty. Pretty is for pictures. You know, so he convinced me. He said, why don't you meet with her again? And if it doesn't go well, you can say no. So I went to my dad and I said, you know, that's what the Rosh Hashiva said. That's what the Rebbe said. And I'm going to go meet her. And my dad says, no. If you meet her again, it's a yes. So I called back my rabbi and I said, listen, this is my father. He said, if your father says that, go meet with her. And if he doesn't like it, I'll pay for the wedding.
What does that mean?
He said, do it without your parents. Get married without your parents. Because I think you should meet with her again and you should decide.
Yeah.
So that's another thing.
Did you tell your dad that?
Yeah. And that's when they said, okay, you know what? Okay, we're going to meet her again. And I met her again, and we actually, you know, it was okay. It was like half an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a good conversation.
Is everyone sitting around? Are they in the other room or what?
So we have our own room. They leave the door open so nothing, you know, can happen.
Uh-huh.
So they can watch over us.
It's crazy, dude.
And I walked out of the room, and I said, let's do it. And that's it. Like 6 months later, I was married.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you didn't talk to her in that 6 months?
No, not at all.
She just came down for the wedding?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I just met her at the wedding.
And you break the glass and you dance on the
chairs?
And
then we go
into
our private room. And then we go into our private room where we sit for like I think 12 minutes is like the Jewish legal time that it takes to, what's the word, copulate?
You go into a room right after the wedding?
No, 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 you don't do it. But you have to be there long enough to be able to do it.
Oh, do some people do it?
No, I don't think so.
Not anymore? Or what? Was it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think anyone does it at the wedding.
Okay, so you do the 12 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And then what?
And then we go party.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you drink wine, dance. You
drink wine, dance.
Get on the chairs.
Get on the chairs.
They walk you around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's happy.
Everyone's happy. I'm happy.
You are?
Well, because I'm thinking like this is like this horrible childhood is finally over. Now I'm on my own. Now I can fix it. Now I can fix
it. But that's interesting because, like, you know, you did get yourself to the point, like, as I did even, you know, when I married my first wife, who was Jewish, and, you know, we went through that whole thing, that, like, all right, well, one of the reasons I did it was because it was familiar and it was, you know, it was expected and it seemed okay. And, but, you know, if you still have those things in your mind or in your heart, it's not never going to be okay. So, all right, so now you're happy. And you go, you get your own place in one of your dad's buildings or what?
No, no, no. So we ended up living in Muncie. My father doesn't have anything over there.
In upstate Muncie, New York?
Muncie, upstate New York, yeah. So we get a little apartment there. And that's when I first started, like, now I have autonomy. Because before that, I was in yeshiva.
Yeah.
All the time. All right, or at my parents' house. I had no autonomy. I was able to go out.
Go out where?
Anywhere. I wasn't able to leave. Like, I was under watch.
But could you read and stuff at this point?
I could read a little bit. My English was a little bit better because I spent some time in England.
Yeah.
And the Hasidic kids from England speak a little bit better English. And so that's when I got a car for the first time.
Yeah.
And I started, talking to people. One of the first places I went was Starbucks.
Yeah.
Like I was just looking for places to interact with, like.
But you're full on hat and.
Oh yeah.
Black
full
and
on,
white.
Yeah. And I started talking to people, and my English got better, and I started listening to this rabbi who like gives lectures in English just to improve my English.
Hasidic rabbi?
No, he wasn't Hasidic. It was like Litvish, like a Lithuanian rabbi. He's very famous, Rabbi Miller. Uh-huh. He gave lectures in English, and in one lecture he mentions something about like how the Goyim are so stupid. They believe in evolution. They believe that everything just made itself. And I'm like, wait, people, what is that? What is that again?
Right.
And I started researching it. Because
you're free to research. You got internet now.
I don't have internet yet. So, like,
You don't have internet yet.
No, there's a process. So, like, first I get the car, and then I get, like, a DVD player. And in the beginning, I would watch anything. I would go to Blockbuster. I would sneak into Blockbuster. I would go to one, like, Ramsey, New Jersey. I would go, like, far away from Muncie. And I would make sure there's no other minivans outside, make sure, like, no one is, there's no other sneakers around.
Yeah.
And I would literally, if it was rated R, I would rent it. Also, here's the other thing.
Where were you watching them?
In my car. Yeah, I had a DVD. I had a whole like hookup where it like plugs into the cigarette lighter. And the thing is like that I didn't even know you could rent movies.
Yeah.
I would go to Blockbuster and buy every movie I wanted to see. And at one point I had so many movies in the trunk of my car that I could not, because I would hide them with a spare tire. I could no longer close it. So I went to a truck stop, you know, and I bought like this DVD sleeves and I threw all the covers out and I just had the DVD. I still have a lot of those.
Who were you hiding it from? Your wife?
My wife, yeah. Yeah.
And once you move in with them, are you talking more with her? Or do you?
Well, we never really connected. We never fought. We were married for 3 years. We never fought. Never had a single fight. But we barely, you know, we barely communicated. She was like doing her own thing, and I was doing my own.
What was she doing?
She worked as like a home health aide.
Uh huh. Yeah, and were you having children?
Yeah, we had a kid like 9 months after we got married. We had our first child, and then a second child a year later.
Uh huh. So you started.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's what happens. You know, if you do it, that's what happens.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Well, you know, I didn't know like condoms and like, you know, and like birth control. I was like, hey, I'm having sex for the first time. This is great. You know?
Right. So you didn't know anything about that?
No, nothing.
Really?
I mean, I knew a little bit.
Right.
Because in yeshiva, you know, boys, there's some boys who know more and they talk, but I'd like not practically.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's also understood that you just have kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're sneaking off, you're renting DVDs, but you're not getting hookers and stuff.
No, not yet.
Oh, really? That happened.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's actually, like, in like maybe, like, a year and a half into my marriage, and I started, like, reading more and, like, getting into, like, science. And one of the only places I could go to speak to Goyim where I felt free and I knew I wasn't going to be seen was a strip club. Because if there was another Hasidic Jew there who saw me, he wouldn't rat on me because he's there too.
Uh-huh.
So the one of the only places I could go to interact with regular people was
about science.
Club.
So you,
but so like this, yeah. So like I had this stripper. This she was like Norwegian or something, you know. Yeah. And she tells me that she's an atheist and she believes in evolution. And I'm like, ooh, I got my Rabbi Miller argument.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I can make you into a believer in like 5 minutes because I still believed at the time. I mean, I was.
What was Rabbi Miller's argument against
it's
atheism?
It's the blind watchmaker. How come something as simple as an ashtray didn't evolve, and something as complicated as a banana or a human did evolve?
Yeah,
you know. So I just lay it on her, and I'm like, "There you go. This is gonna do it." And she looks at me and she says, "You know, it's not the same thing." And I'm like, "Why?" She's like, "Because an ashtray isn't biological." Right. And I'm like, whoa, wow, right. And like I told the story to Penn Jillette, and he says like, oh, it's amazing how much more convincing an argument becomes with a pair of tits in your face. But yeah, so I went home after that night and I was like, wow.
After the strip club
and I was like, oh my god, I gotta get to the bottom of this. Yeah. And a couple of months later I was like, yeah, I'm done, there's no god, this is bullshit.
Uh-huh. And that was when you were 23?
I was like 22, almost 22, yeah.
22, yeah. Two kids. A bunch of hidden DVDs in your trunk.
Yep.
You're sleeping with strippers.
Yeah, well, not sleeping with them, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, eventually I did start, you know, seeing hookers because I was like, all right, well, it's got to be more to sex than just...
But you went with hookers because you couldn't really find anyone else who's going to fuck a chassid.
Yeah, also I didn't know how.
You didn't know how to talk to girls. You had no game.
Well,
how are you going to have game when you got payas and a hat?
Yeah, well, even when I have payas for a role, I can still find my way around, you know.
Well, you seem a little more well-adjusted.
Yeah, I'm, yeah.
So.
Somewhat.
Well, but so what does it take? So now that you, when you started seeing hookers or started not believing in God, I mean, how long?
I didn't think I was going to talk about hookers on the podcast.
It's okay. But how long before you're like, I got to get out of this?
So at a certain point, I stopped caring. And I brought my computer home. I bring the DVDs home. And me and my wife, we had an agreement. We were like, you know what? You do your thing as long as the kids don't know. As long as on Shabbos, you come home, you do a meal, you pretend everything
is fine.
So
she's sleeping with people?
No. She's very religious. You know, she remarried. She has a bunch of more kids, you know. She's in.
Right.
So we had an agreement.
Okay.
You know, I mean, like I was doing my thing, she was doing her thing, and it was okay.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, she started, you know, saying like, okay, this is not going to work. You know, we got to make up our minds. You know,
about what? Divorce?
No, are you going to be religious or you're not going to be religious? And she went and told her dad, and her dad came up to me after prayers Friday night, and he said, listen, I
know. In Muncie. Because you're at his temple.
Yes. So he says, you know, I know, and I need you to make me a promise that you're going to be religious. And I said, you know, I don't make promises that I can't keep. And he says, well, then you got to let her go.
Yeah.
I said, okay. And that was on a Friday night, and on Tuesday I was divorced. Just that quick.
You got to get?
I got a legal divorce, done, out.
No money things, no nothing, just you're done.
Yeah. You can have whatever you want. You know, I don't need anything. I just want out. There's a whole world out there. I want to see it.
And that was it.
And I lost. I got fired immediately from my job.
Which job?
I was working at a liquor store at the time.
A Hasidic liquor store?
Yeah. And so because I was open about not keeping Shabbos anymore, so if I touch kosher wine, it becomes non-kosher.
Oh, and that's why you got fired? Outside the fact that everyone knew in the community that you did this thing.
Yeah, but I can't work at a wine store. You know, right. I'm gonna.
If you don't keep Shabbos at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a matter of the day of Shabbos. If you're a guy that doesn't keep Shabbos, you can't touch any booze.
You can't touch any kosher wine, yeah.
No shit.
Yeah.
You're like a goy.
A goy.
Like, black magic. No, well, if a goy touches not...
A goy cannot touch wine, kosher wine.
Really?
Yeah. It becomes non-kosher. Unless it's pasteurized. If it's not pasteurized, if it's like regular wine, then yeah. That's what makes wine kosher. The only thing that makes wine kosher is that it hasn't been touched by a goy. There's no special process to it. It just has not been touched by a goy.
Uh-huh. It's so funny because Manischewitz and like Mad Dog 2020 was such a popular fucking, you know, wino, alky, street-level drunk shit. Mad Dog was like, and that's a Manischewitz product, I think.
But Hasidim don't drink Manischewitz. It's not kosher enough.
It's not.
No.
Oh, okay.
There's actually a lot of very, very good kosher wines. There's like really expensive kosher wines.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, from Israel and from like France and yeah. There's like a lot of really nice kosher wine. I learned everything I know about wine. I know from working in the kosher wine store.
Uh-huh. All right, so you get fired. You basically exiled yourself from that community. So how long before you had to pack up your shit and go?
Immediately.
Oh, really?
Immediately. I was immediately out. Well, my wife kept the apartment. I had nowhere to live.
Where'd you go?
So I was crashing in a friend's basement for a while on like a mattress on the floor in Muncie, yeah.
Another Hasidic guy?
Another, like, he was like on the fringe. You know, it was like an older single guy, which is also very unusual.
Yeah.
And he was living alone and Tolk, other crazy story, that guy, like his dad is like a big deal in Vegas, like in casino business, and his dad is not religious and he became Hasidic and then he became like modern Orthodox and then he doesn't know who he is, but he had this place in Muncie and I was crashing with him.
But he didn't go to your temple?
No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
I just knew him through friends, yeah.
Oh, all right, and then what?
Yeah, and then I decide that I'm going to, and then I joined Footsteps, which is the organization that you see in the movie.
In Brooklyn.
In Manhattan, yeah.
Yeah.
They're based in Manhattan.
This is for Jews, Hasidic Jews who want out.
Yes. And they help you with like shelter and food and high school diplomas, job search.
They're basically, really?
Yeah. Because you come out there and you know nothing. You know, you don't know what a resume is because that's not how Hasidic Jews get jobs. They don't have resumes. They're like, oh, you know Yankel Favish? Oh, yeah, he's hiring. Oh, yeah, you want to work for him? Do you know how to use a computer? Yeah, I'll figure it out. Yeah. All right, good, you're hired. That is literally how it works. It's like you can get any job. It's like, you know, they think of most things, they're like, if a goy can do it, I can do it.
Right.
The difference is a goy has to go to college to learn how to do it, and I can figure it out on my own.
Oh, right, that's how it goes.
That's how it goes.
So there is a sort of like, that sort of judgment, you know, it's interesting because that idea of the difference between Jews and non-Jews is not specific to Hasidim. And, you know, it's sort of that thing is stuck, you know, through conservative Jewishness and I imagine some Reformed Jewishness that the chosen people that we're more educated, that we know.
Well, it's worse with Hasidim.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah.
But it is a Jewish thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Of course, yeah. Yeah, and it's actually worse by Hasidim and unjustified too.
Right, from what you're telling me. Yeah, because they're all dummies.
Well, you know, the thing is they're street smart. They're very street smart.
They're street smart.
That's why they love Trump.
They're street smart in the way that the streets of Borough Park.
No, in general, in business too. That's why they like Trump. They don't like data and numbers and experts.
Yeah.
They'd go with their gut and they go, like, that's why they love him.
Yeah.
They're like, he's our kind of guy. He's like, hey, fuck the establishment. I know how to do this.
Yeah.
So what? You're an expert. You know?
That's it? That's in the Talmud?
No, but then like the proof is in the pudding. You know? Like, well, he's a billionaire, so he must know something.
But aren't there rules about business in the first five books?
Yeah, there are, yes.
And they don't have to deal with that?
Well, those only apply to Jews.
Yeah.
Jews dealing with Jews. So like, when you deal with Goyim, you don't have to follow those rules.
Mm.
So there's actually, the law is, the Jewish law is, that if you go to a Jewish store and they give you the wrong change, you have to return it.
Yeah.
But if you're at a non-Jewish store and they give you the wrong change, you don't have to return it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's in the book.
That's in the book.
No,
it's an actual law. Yeah. They say that you should return it to give the Jews a good name.
Right. But if you don't give a fuck.
But if you don't give a fuck, then you don't have to return it.
Yeah, we're not going to hold you responsible.
Yeah.
That's between you and God.
Yeah, and I was arguing like Noam Dorman from the seller. We were arguing about it. He's like, well, they say that because I said that the Jewish law is that you cannot violate the Sabbath to save a non-Jew's life.
Yeah.
And he said that, well, that's not in the book. And I said, well, let's look it up. And we looked it up and it says, like the latest ruling on that is that you're not allowed to, but you should, because otherwise the goyim are gonna say that the Jews are not allowed to violate the Sabbath to save a goy's life.
Right.
So it's like it's optics. So legally you can,
but it's also adaptation. It's not just optics,
right?
Because there's something about those kind of rules where it's sort of like because always at the core of this, certainly in modern Hasidim, is that, you know, we don't want to make trouble with the goys because we need them.
They're
going to kill us.
You're right. Yeah. And here I am spilling the secrets, and now they know. they're definitely going to kill us.
The ones that want to kill you know.
Yeah.
They already know. That's the problem.
Yeah.
What about you and your kids?
Oof. Yeah, that's the... Now we're getting there.
Was that heartbreaking? It's got to be heartbreaking. How long did you know them for?
Well, my son was almost three. My oldest was almost three when I left.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't know them for that long.
And they're not going to... And then they have the option, like theoretically, her family and her, that, you know, if they can keep you away permanently, they'll have no memory of you.
Yeah. But they know. They know I exist because they know they have like three sets of grandparents.
Right. Oh, and, so your parents are still a part of their life.
Yeah.
They let them do that.
Yeah. And also like when they get called to the Torah, when he gets bar mitzvah, you know, he's going to be called to the Torah. They're not going to call him, you know, his name and his stepfather's name. They're going to say my name.
They have to.
Yeah. So he's going to know. He's going to know that his father's name is not.
So what's your relationship with them?
I have no relationship. I haven't seen them since.
Isn't that horrible?
Yeah. It's I think it's best for everyone that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it's,
you know,
hard to explain. You know, but
because it would complicate things with no solution.
Yeah, exactly. I still think that the most important thing in life is to be happy. You know, I think it's more important than the truth, which is weird coming from me. And I think that even though my kids are being raised in a community and in a faith that I don't believe in, that I think is morally wrong. I think that you know, their mother is a lovely mother and their stepfather is a lovely dad, and they're being raised and they're going to be happy. They're not going to have a horrible childhood like me, and they'll grow up to be happy Hasidim maybe. And if I just come in and confuse them, and you know, I don't think it does anyone any favors.
Right, you know? Because you're not taking a stand in the sense that, you know, you want to out the community you came from to destroy it, because you know you can't.
Yeah, so, I would like for it to end.
Yeah,
you know, but I know I can't, and that's not what I'm trying to do. That's the other thing. Like, I'm not an activist. Like, there's some people who leave and they become activists. I'm not. You know, I'm in it for myself. You know, I'm building a career. You know, I'm building a life.
Yeah, but see the sort of premise of responsibility and following the rules, no matter how bizarre and limiting they are, you know, give you a sense of, you know, I guess on some level, there must be some good chassids.
Oh, there are many. There are many.
Like that rabbi you knew in Yeshiva that, you know, that are doing good in the world, or at least honoring God in a way that isn't cruel.
Yeah. But did you know that every hospital in the New York City tri-state area has a room called the Bikur Cholim room, which means visiting the sick.
Yeah.
And there are buses full of volunteers that go from hospital to hospital every single day and fill those fridges with free food.
Chassidim.
Yes. You can go to any hospital and you'll see some door with like Hebrew letters on it and a combination lock on it. And everybody know, the people in the community know the combination lock. And if you're like a Hasidic person or a Jewish person for that matter, who is in any New York City hospital, you find the Bikur Cholim room and you can eat for free if you're visiting family.
Hmm.
And there are people, volunteers, mothers with big families.
And this is any Jew. This is not a missionary work.
No. This is pure service. Volunteer, pure service. And if you get a flat tire in Borough Park or in Williamsburg or Muncie, you call Chavayrim, which is an organization, all volunteers, and they will come and they will change your tire. They'll give you a boost. They'll dig you out of the snow. If you get locked out of your apartment, they have locksmiths, volunteer locksmiths.
Only Jews?
They only come for Jews, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have Hatzalah, their own ambulance service, all volunteer, you know, less than 2 minute response time.
So given that, so you have to acknowledge in your heart and in your mind that they're despite your problems with the insulation of the community, that your kids, you know, have a shot at being okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if I came into their lives, I would, you know, the chances would decrease.
But how do you rationalize the selfishness of your pursuit?
Yeah, well, Mary, I rationalize it by the fact that I wasn't given a choice.
Because the rules were as such.
Yeah.
Allow you to live in both worlds.
Yeah. If I impregnated someone now, I would deal with it a lot differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would take responsibility because now I know.
Right. So you were saying that on some level that you were, that your sort of, you were stifled and
indoctrinated
by the confines and cult-like nature of the community. Yeah. So how did it unfold with your father, that, you know, the falling out again? He just...
Well, he called me up and he said, "Oh, are you in this video, One of Us?" So my father, like, he obviously has never seen a movie. He doesn't, like, for example, when Felix and Mira came out.
Yeah.
And
the Canadian film about the Hasid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I was in.
Yeah.
It was actually Canada's entry for the foreign language Oscar that year. You know, it did really well.
Yeah.
And I told my father, we were talking at the time, I said, I'm going, because we premiered at Toronto Film Festival, and I said, I'm going to Toronto for the premiere of the film.
He's like,
"Oh, so you're going to go and act the movie over there?" I said, no. We're going to go and play the movie. It's like, "Oh, you're not going to act it?" "No, Dad, I already acted it. They're going to show a video of me." "Oh, they're going to show a video? Then why do you need to be there?" You know, he just doesn't understand, like, play, movie,
really?
Video. He doesn't get it at all. Yeah.
No kidding.
He has no idea.
Yeah. It would seem that he would enjoy the Yiddish show. Yeah.
And my dad is very, very funny. My dad is very funny.
You can't get him to come to a show?
No. Even if I could, he wouldn't want to be seen. I mean, he's the Rebbe. I mean, it's like the Rebbe going to a show, a mixed
but
seating.
That's where the fight is, though, dude. Right, to get your fucking siblings to come see, you know, something.
Some of my siblings come. I'm not going to out which one of them.
But it's fundamentally Jewish.
Not to them. You don't understand. Like, I didn't know who Shalom Aleichem was. I didn't know who Isaac Bashevis Singer was. Even, that's the thing, even secular Yiddish literature has no place in that world. There's only Hasidic literature.
Hmm.
You know, I never heard of, like, the Borscht Belt. I found out about the Borscht Belt 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I didn't know about those comedians.
Huh.
I didn't.
So are you doing any writing?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit here and there. I'm working on we're trying to bounce off of One of Us and trying to create a series loosely based on my life.
Uh-huh.
On a guy who left the community and, like, in trying to make it.
But
out
it
in
seems
the world.
Like that philosophically, you know, to sort of bridge this gap, because like your struggle ultimately, since you can't completely extricate yourself from the community, you know, both as a character and as somebody who grew up in it, that, you know, and the only way that you become a real threat is, you know, it's like it's the struggle you had with your father-in-law. Where it just becomes down, if you're not going to be religious, you got to tell me. But it seems to me that there is a way to, the way you become a real rebel without being an activist is to engage elements of the community in your creativity.
Oh, I am. I am. I meet people all the time. Like, if I go to Bara Pakistan, I miss the food and I go and get some chulent or some kugel or, you know, and someone would come up to me and, you know, and tell me that they saw, you know, Felix and Mira, and they're really inspired. I have met people
who are still in the community.
Yeah, well, I met when I was when Felix and Mira premiered in London. I had these kids who came to the premiere, and they had no payas, no beard, and said that, like, watching my growth, and watching me go out there, and, you know, quote unquote making it in the outside world, helped them to leave. People are leaving because of me. People are, you know, they get some encouragement from it.
Yeah, I just wonder if you could ever, like, if it ever becomes like Catholicism or something, where, you know, exceptions have to be made to where they can expand their horizons.
What do you mean?
That eventually, you know, that, but it's so insulated and so genetically kind of like a closed system that you would think that eventually, like, just to integrate, but they don't want to.
No, they don't want to, you know. And it's funny, like, going back to what I said about all the good things they do.
Yeah.
You know, like, you have also, even that, you have to compare it to North Korea.
Yeah.
He does give his people healthcare. He does give his people education.
Yeah, but he's not, but the rabbis are not hanging their people in front of other people.
Yeah, no. But they're hanging children who get sexually abused.
Hanging them out to dry, you mean?
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Did that happen to you?
Yeah. I've talked about that in the past, yeah.
By who?
By a private tutor. 3 years from now, when I was 9 until I was 12.
And did you tell your father?
No.
You didn't tell anybody?
No. I didn't know, because he was the only guy I trusted.
And
I didn't get along with my parents, and he was my only friend.
And that's how he took advantage of it?
Yeah.
And did you know other kids that were in the same situation?
No, I didn't know it. And so I didn't find out about that he was doing it to other kids until my parents called me and told me about it. And that's when they asked me, like, "Oh, we know he does it to other kids. Did he do that to you?"
And what happened to that guy?
Nothing.
That's horrible.
Still teaches.
Heinous.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you seem okay, and I'm glad the career is working out.
Yeah, for now, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm staying negative, you know.
Don't. I mean, don't, I mean, I don't know how much guilt you carry.
A lot. I listen to you, and like sometimes the thing that holds me together is like, I just hope it doesn't take me until I'm 50.
To figure it out.
I don't know. Like, you seem to have, you know, figured it out. At least figured out your shit and how to deal with it and how to contain it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, success helps with that a little bit.
Yeah.
And also, but there are some things that, you know, they're unreconcilable. And I think some of them, you know, seek spiritual solutions to enable you the freedom of mind and heart to at least let go of some things. And yeah. I don't necessarily engage that. And I fight that myself. And you live with that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to compartmentalize something. But you know, that's one of the reasons why people, you know, choose spirituality or have some sort of, even if it's a dogmatic system for processing shame or, you know, guilt or righteousness. You know, if you're just winging it, it's a selfish endeavor, and there's still emptiness there.
Yeah.
But that's something you have to accept.
Yeah, or try to figure it out and, like, just drive yourself insane.
I don't know what there is to figure out.
I don't know either. It's very confusing. It's the whole thing. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and if this were a Hasidic tale, it would end with, so, what do we do? Let's go talk to the Rebbe.
And then we had a l'chaim and some cake, and the goyim died.
All right, buddy. Thanks,
thank
man.
You. Thank you.
Man, that's something else. Religion. Huh? Really, I guess that the Hasidic community is sort of a version of extreme religious nerds. Is that possible? Probably not. I mean, I think probably the cult model is more correct. I got the Telecaster back. I strung it up, and I just tuned the guitar. Okay, so let's do this.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.